We're at the Society for Neuroscience meeting in San Diego. Convention Center's just up the street. We're in the Grand Hyatt. And we're doing a second installment of a meeting that was last done in the Master's Lodge at Trinity College, Cambridge, earlier this year with Molly Crockett, Patricia Churchland. Molly just finished her PhD in experimental psychology at Cambridge and heading off to Ernst Fehr's establishment in Zurich. And Patricia Churchland, as it says in this issue of New Scientist for 16 October 2010, where you have a piece, is a philosopher of neuroscience at the University of California and the Salk Institute, both in San Diego. And her book, Brain Trust, What Neuroscience Tells Us About Morality, will be published by Princeton in March 2011. So we have two things going on. We have your book and the talk that you gave at the Origins of Violence, Origins of Morality mm-hmm. piece that we just did at ASU, which is on the website now. We have the fact that you're at the Neuroethics Society meeting, satellite meeting a little bit earlier, talking about some of those issues. And we have, since we last talked, Molly's paper on serotonin that came out in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. So I can actually stand back from this and you can almost catch up because you've read the paper, right?
I have read it. I guess it was in manuscript form some time ago, but I think what would be useful would be for you to just tell us the heart of the paper.
Okay. Well, I just presented this at the poster session yesterday, so I'm well practiced.
Yes.
Basically, we wanted to look at the effects of a serotonin drug, a serotonin reuptake inhibitor, mm-hmm. citalopram, on moral judgment in these classic trolley problems that have been used in the neuroscience setting. And also in the ultimatum game, which we looked at previously. Yeah. We, in our study, gave people a single dose of the SSRI and compared that with placebo as well as with a noradrenaline reuptake inhibitor, which gave us a sort of extra control mm-hmm. condition so we could look at whether these effects are specific to serotonin. Mm-hmm. So what we basically found in the trolley problems, we have them framed basically in personal terms, so very emotionally salient, mm-hmm. visceral harms, and also impersonal scenarios where the harms in question are sort of more abstract.
So at a distance.
At a distance, yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so we found that the effects of the serotonin drug were specific to the emotionally salient personal scenarios. It made people less utilitarian. Mm-hmm. So people were less willing to endorse harming one person to save many others mm-hmm. on the SSRI relative to both placebo and the noradrenaline drug. The effects were highly selective as well as varying according with trait empathy in our subjects. Mm-hmm. So the effects of the drug were actually strongest in those individuals who were highest in trait empathy. So the story that we sort of get out of the findings is that perhaps serotonin promotes pro-social behavior by making people more averse to harming others. Mm-hmm. And this fits with the trait empathy findings as mm-hmm. well. Mm-hmm. So based on the other research that's been done with the moral judgment, we think that these effects may be taking place in ventromedial prefrontal cortex and amygdala, although we have to do brain imaging mm-hmm. follow-up mm-hmm. to be sure.
Yeah.
But that's the basic.
It is a very, very interesting finding. Although, do you think that the emotions are engaged in all moral dilemmas, that is, even those when we might make, as it were, the tough decision to save five by sacrificing one, as well as in the other decision where we stand back and sort of let the trolley roll over the five? I mean, do you think that there are emotions involved in both cases?
Yeah, I think it's I think that certainly emotions are involved in any kind of decision where there's such a conflict. Yeah. It's just a question of what emotions are involved and sort
right.
of specifically which emotions are being modulated by serotonin and other neurotransmitters.
Pat, one of the things that came up at the ASU meeting and the workshop before it was this philosopher's territory of mm-hmm. the difference between a utilitarian perspective and a deontological perspective. And it got a little bit murky in
my
view.
It did, I think.
And what Molly's saying here is basically people became more deontological and straight you know, in their moral postures here, and less utilitarian.
With higher levels of serotonin.
But how does that language fit together with?
I don't know whether that's particularly consistent or not. The analysis of the trolley problem, I think, should be done, and it should be done very carefully. I mean, I think that you did a very reasonable thing, because what you were basically doing was taking that as a sort of standard problem, and then let's have a look at what this particular manipulation does and how that might stack up against other manipulations. But, you know, and Simon Blackburn, I think, has made this point really well, and that is that most of life, most of the time, really doesn't involve a question of should I sacrifice five people to save one, or should I pull the lever and should I push the guy off? It really doesn't. It really isn't like that. It's not to say that our moral lives are not complicated and fraught with deep and divisive dilemma, but these highly contrived cases. I mean, I'm not a young person, but I have to, and I've lived in all kinds of very odd circumstances, but I have to tell you that never once in my life have I encountered anything even remotely analogous to the trolley problem. Now, there have been lots of interesting and difficult moral dilemmas, which I felt I was part of, and so forth. So I think it's very hard to know whether the people who say they would push the fat man versus the people who say, no, let the five die, whether this is a matter of emotions versus sort of cold cognition, which I very much doubt, because as you pointed out, the emotions are engaged in both cases, or whether it's a matter of feeling that you don't want to actually do the physical thing, or whether something else entirely is going on. Now, here's a very interesting sort of story. There were philosophers who were talking to Russian philosophers about the trolley problem, and they wanted the take of the Russian philosophers on would they push the guy off or would they not. And the Russians said, there's always a better way. We wouldn't do, you know, of course, we were told throughout our lives that we sacrifice the one for the many. But we know there's always a better way. And we know that life is always more complicated, and that you can't, with any certainty, say five will certainly die and one will be saved versus five will be saved. Because we're always making decisions under tremendous uncertainty. We often don't know what the consequences would be. In these very, very contrived cases, we do. But these are truly, truly unrealistic. So I've often wondered if some people aren't simply reacting to the lack of realism in these cases and kind of responding a bit like the Russian philosophers and saying, there's always a better way. So what I think, of course, is tremendously important about your work is that you are seeing a role in moral judgment under a variety of kinds of conditions for serotonin, and that it makes a difference to how we perceive the moral situation and how we act. What I would like to know is what that really is. What really is the nature of the difference that serotonin is actually making?
Well, and you couldn't just restrict it to that. I was talking to Paul Zak yesterday afternoon, Dr. Love, of course, who and was talking to him about oxytocin, something that you've spent a lot of time thinking
about.
And we were talking about oxytocin and dopamine and serotonin and the complexity of that system and how to parse it. I mean, it's just
not
easy, is it?
Well, they all interact with one another, so really, It's very, very difficult to isolate the effects of a single neurotransmitter, because in my studies, for example, I've manipulated serotonin, but in manipulating serotonin, I'm also potentially manipulating dopamine, oxytocin, noradrenaline, these other neurotransmitters that are all functionally interacting. And not only that, but they are all very finely tuned homeostatically such that any manipulation you do in the lab is going to perturb this very delicate balance that's you know evolved throughout the course of evolution, and you know it's. They're very blunt tools that we have right now.
Let me read you this paragraph. I read this out at Arizona. I've done it a couple of times since, but it does seem to me quite useful to address this issue. This is the Fiery Cushman's opening piece in the Opinion Special and the New Scientist piece, where we have long thought of moral laws as fixed points of reality, self-evident truths, rooted in divine command or in some platonic realm of absolute rights and wrongs. But new research is offering an alternative explaining moral attitudes in the context of evolution, culture, and the neural architecture of our brains. This apparent reduction of morality to a scientific specimen can seem threatening, but it needn't. Rather, by unmasking our minds as the authors of morality, we may be better able to bend its narrative arc towards a happy end. A little bit of hyperbole in there, but I mean, that would be kind of your default position, wouldn't it?
I think that I do agree that as we have a deeper and richer understanding of how it is that we are social animals and how it is that the reward system is tuned up and how it is that our frontal structures, which Molly and other people study, how it is that frontal structures enable us to look further into the future and evaluate possible consequences. These things, I think, will give us a sort of broader, deeper perspective that I think, in general, will make a difference. What I would hope, however, is that Cushman is not buying into something which I think is actually quite dangerous, and that is the idea that we should be act utilitarians. That is, that we should always act for any given choice in such a way as to maximize aggregate utility. Now, there are many reasons why that's a bad idea. One of them, of course, has to do with the fact that act utilitarians are quite willing to do things such as hang an innocent person in order to prevent a riot that will kill many. They're willing to sacrifice any value in the name of happiness. Now, the main problem with that, of course, in real life, is that we make these decisions under uncertainty. We often don't know what the consequences would be. So it might actually serve us better to abide by rules in many circumstances, not, as Josh Green would say, because we are sort of slavishly emotionally attached to those rules, but because we think that abiding by those rules will, in the long run, over time, serve us better than trying to do these really impossible calculations that the act utilitarians say that we should. Act utilitarians are, I think, at a social disadvantage. If I know that someone in my group is an act utilitarian who wants to maximize aggregate utility all the time, I'm actually afraid of this guy. I can't count on him to be loyal, to be honest, to keep promises, to respect the rules of justice. I can't even, as Simon Blackburn pointed out, count on such a person to, if he's a referee in a tennis game, to abide by the rules if breaking the rules will increase aggregate happiness of those in the stands. So it's actually, I think, in a curious way, and this is not a point that's new with me, this is a point that's been made many times by people who understand the complexities of moral life much better than I. But being, and in particular, John Stuart Mill understood this, that being an act utilitarian, where you're supposed to maximize aggregate happiness, puts you in a very, very dangerous position.
So it's a mistake to, I'm just curious, this is a little footnote, it's a mistake to lump Mill with Bentham, isn't it?
Mill and Bentham were very, very different.
Yes.
Bentham did tend to want to maximize aggregate happiness. Mill, on the other hand, realized that that would lead to all kinds of very unpleasant results. He felt that, amongst other things, it would be very intrusive. You might want to intervene in my life in order to maximize my happiness and make a travesty of my autonomy by doing certain things to me that I actually don't want. But in your judgment about what's good for my happiness, you could intrude. Mill also thought that there was nothing wrong with my playing the violin on an afternoon where, in fact, I could be increasing the aggregate happiness of the multitudes if I was working in a soup kitchen or vaccinating people against TB. But Mill said, you're not obliged. It's fine to play the violin and grow potatoes and take a walk, even if you're not maximizing aggregate happiness. So Mill took a very, very different view. And part of the reason that Mill did was that he saw how important freedom and autonomy are as fundamental values for humans. So where he thought that utilitarian considerations, consequences kicked in was when it was possible that my doing something might actually directly damage or harm someone. And that's very, very different. It's a harder position to defend. I mean, any witless maximizing utilitarian can just stamp their foot and say, well, that's it, that's how I do it. I would just hang the guy and justice be damned. Mill's position is just a lot more subtle, a lot more sophisticated, and I think true to real moral life as we live it.
Yeah. Do you, as part of your training and so on, did you have, you, how much philosophy did you have to do?
not a whole lot.
But is this something that would, it seems to me that you're almost sort of people in this field are almost compelled to go and look at this sort of stuff now, because it's the two things are intersecting to such an extent.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're all interested in human nature. We just use very different tools to understand it.
And so
I think that, you know, what people in the Robbins Lab, like Molly and others, are doing is really very complementary to those of us who haven't really necessarily made up our minds about many of these things, but who kind of want to see how things look when more data comes in. And I think these research projects are very complementary, actually.
Well, you know, the example that was given at the workshop of I think it was Josh Green, was talking about whether he felt a certain reluctance or indeed guilt at having an elaborate birthday party for his child when, you know, as he said, looking up at Peter Singer, or invoking Peter Singer, perhaps he should have been giving that money to needy people in distant parts of the world. It's an argument you've made as well about should you feel, in some sense, like a moral outlaw that you're caring so deeply for your children when you could actually pay some attention to the less fortunate somewhere?
Yes, and I think Mill's answer here is very helpful, which is, of course, you're not. You know, one of the problems about maximizing aggregate utility is that none of us can live that way. We all do love our children, and we are going to do things for our children that we're not going to do for unknown, needy children on the other side of the planet. Now, one of the things that you could conclude, therefore, is that morality is this high, lofty, lofty thing that, poor us, we are so fraught and sinful and weak, we'll never manage to reach, which I think is silly. I think that we want a conception of morality, including values and some rules and so forth, that is meaningful to people in their everyday lives. And consequently, if the maximizing utilitarians end up with this lofty, impossible ideal, whereby I always feel guilty because instead of planting potatoes, I should be off, I don't know, saving fish. It's not connected to real life. And you know, one of the great, great things about both Hume and Aristotle is they keep making this point, which I didn't used to understand as an undergraduate, that morality is a very practical business. And I used to think, yeah, well, what else? But in the light of seeing how some theologians and some philosophers view morality, I understand now what Hume and Aristotle meant. It has to be workable. Ought implies can. You shouldn't be telling me that I ought not to care for my children more than I care for the children in Kazakhstan, when that's not possible.
Yeah, I asked, off in a previous conversation, I was talking to Molly and saying, doesn't the work you're doing, do you not see it somewhere down the line as possibly having practical applications in yes. you know, people, instead of people killing each other in Gaza or something, yeah. just try and find out what is going on operationally in terms of these folk psychological words like trust yes. and virtue yes. and so on. I mean, and this still, there's this long tradition of virtue ethics going back
Absolutely.
All this way, but there's also now the neuroscience to at least give some finesse to it, I think.
I think that's right. And you know, to sort of get a profile of the differences that it can make to a single person in this condition versus that condition, where I mean condition, pharmacological condition, or, you know, sleep deprive them and what difference does that make, or mm-hmm. terrify them first and then ask them about the trolley problem, or, you know, give them a warm bath and then ask them about their trolley problem, or better yet, don't use the trolley problem.
Right. Well, I mean, I think really the goal of a lot of this work is to try and understand the mechanisms so that perhaps one day in the future we can engineer situations
yeah.
to bring out the best in people, because what we know about morality is that humans are capable of doing really great things for one another, mm-hmm. as are primates. And mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, yesterday there were posters on empathy in mice. I mean, these are really evolutionarily mm-hmm. old mm-hmm. processes. And I think by understanding the mechanisms, and especially by understanding how the context and the situation influences these processes, then we can start to think about trying to engineer situations and environments that can really take advantage of these old automatic mechanisms so mm. that we can mm. promote social well-being in the easiest yeah. way possible.
Empathy in yeah. mice?
Yeah. Yeah, they were, it may have been rats, but the poster was about...
Small scurrying creatures, nevertheless.
Yes, indeed. They will work to free a trapped cage mate.
Ah, isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Yes.
So, okay. And this goes up to Joan Silk's work, of course, as well, doesn't it, with monkeys as well? She's done some stuff on that.
Well, I mean, there's wonderful work has been done with marmosets on this. And marmosets contrast a little bit with chimpanzees. So the work in the lab shows that if you have a tray and the animal is out the cage and he has to pull the ropes in order to get the food, but there is another marmoset here, this marmoset will pull the tray even if the only marmoset to get the food is the one next door. Chimpanzees won't. So if there's two chimps, I have to pull the tray. If we're each going to get some, I'll pull. But if I have to pull, and you're the only one who's going to get it, and I'm a chimpanzee, I tend not to do it. So there are interesting differences. But of course, in their social structure, marmosets are very different from chimpanzees. Marmosets are long-term pair bonders. The males
Parental nurture, the
males are actually, in a way, more devoted parents to the offspring than the females. And, you know, they're sort of comparable in size, these funny little guys. And chimpanzees simply, it doesn't mean that they're any, you know, less moral or whatever, but I mean, they just have a different way of going about their business. Now, what Brian Hare thinks is that the chimpanzees have a higher level of tension, probably higher cort levels and lower oxytocin levels, largely maybe because of the environment in which they live. Life is very competitive. Whereas for the marmosets, they have lower cortisol levels and higher oxytocin levels, and you know, they're much more, you want me to help you get some food, I'll help you get some food.
Now you're actually quite clearly state that you view oxytocin and other associated neurochemicals, transmitters, and so on as the platform for morality. You actually use the phrase a platform for morality, right? Mm. That's no messing about there.
No, I think that it is, except that I should, of course, say that it's oxytocin, serotonin, dopamine,
yes, and
vasopressin in the context of the circuitry of the subcortical structures, but also, of course, as it relates to cortex. And the reason that we think that, of course, has to do with the evolution of the mammalian brain, so that with pre-mammals, things like frogs and newts and so on, there is adequate structure in the brainstem for maintaining self-survival and self-well-being. And what happened in the mammalian brain, and I think the evolution of this is not entirely understood, is that you get changes in the circuitry so that the self-caring mechanisms kind of expand to embrace the offspring. And that's the huge difference. And then once you've moved from self-caring to other caring, then other changes can come so that there's caring for mates, or maybe not caring for mates, but caring for kin, or maybe caring for affiliates and so forth. Mm-hmm. But the big change, and so I'm not surprised in a way that we see this in mice, the big change is the change that goes from seeing to my own survival and well-being to also seeing to the survival and well-being of others. And so that's why I call it the platform, but it's only the platform because tuning up the reward system is an important thing and because problem solving is an important thing. And you tune up the reward system as I learn about the ways of others, which uncle is cantankerous, which auntie is nice, when it's okay to take food and when it's not, and so forth.
Yeah. What's the next phase of experimentation for you?
I'm going to be doing a lot of behavioral experiments in Zurich, trying to get more at the mechanism, but informed by what we know from neuroscience. So using economic games like the ultimatum game, public goods game, but tweaking them a bit to tap into what we know about decision-making systems in the brain. And also some additional experiments with serotonin and oxytocin.
So yes, I'm curious. So do you think that the willingness to punish, which we've seen studied so beautifully by Fair and Gachter, do you think the willingness to punish in these games will be altered by altering levels of serotonin?
Well, we've already shown that serotonin manipulation.
Oh, yes, you have, actually. That's true. I'm sorry, I forgot.
Yeah. As for oxytocin, I think it's a mixed bag. There have been some people showing that it does affect it and others showing that it doesn't. There was actually a brilliant paper that came out in June, I think, by Karsten de Drew at the University of Amsterdam, showing that oxytocin administration increases punishment of out-group members.
Right. But not in-group. Yes.
Increases generosity to in-group members.
Yeah. Very interesting.
So again, we see context by chemistry interactions, which, I mean, it's this thing pops up again and again.
So what would you take from that, though? I mean,
it's hard to know what you would take from it in a practical way, but I think in a scientific context, it does give us a deeper understanding of the significance of in-group versus out-group, and the role that serotonin plays in bonding, and that serotonin, like vasopressin, is almost certainly context sensitive. So we know in vasopressin that it makes the daddy rats more nurturing to their own pups, but it also makes them more ferocious in dealing with intruders. And the guess would be, I think, that oxytocin is probably like that too. It makes you more generous with those to whom you are bonded, and more ferocious and pushing away, not ferocious, I guess, but more disinclined to be neighborly with those who are in the out-group.
Now, what's this? Final thing here. What's this? There's another meeting that you're going to later on today. What's that about?
This is a sort of social meeting of the Neuroethics Society, where the idea really is just people to get together and chat a little bit. But in order to kind of kick things off, there will be a panel who will talk a bit about addiction and choice and decision making in addicted subjects.
Okay, so but this is all part of the same territory, isn't it? I mean, essentially.
Yes, of course. Yeah, I mean, this kind of comes at the problem from the vantage point of free will. And I think it is a good idea at the neuroscience meetings to talk about free will and decision making, because there has been a kind of unfortunate tendency to think that if decisions are caused, and of course they are, then people should not be held responsible for them, which is sort of like saying then people's reward systems should not be tuned up with reward and punishment. So I think we want to talk a little bit about why that's an unfortunate and probably unproductive view about responsibility.
Yeah, I think Steve Hyman said at the opening session at the satellite meeting, was making the point about addiction, that diagnosis is not absolution.
Yeah, or that an explanation is not an excuse. And,
right.
And I think one of the things that we need to be very mindful of is that people in the wider community, I mean, these are reasonable, intelligent people in the wider community who are very interested in what neuroscience can tell us about ourselves, are very perturbed when they hear well-known scientists come out and proclaim, we have no free will. You know, essentially, we all have brain tumors. No one should ever really go to jail for anything. I mean, this is ludicrous. And it's unproductive, and it's not really a reflection, I think, of what's deep and true about the discoveries in neuroscience. It's a very facile and, oddly enough, Cartesian idea about what you need in order to make responsible choice.
Do you think you have free will, Molly?
I hope so.
Well, of my own free will, I think we have to bring this to a close now.
Yes, yes.
And it's great to see you both again.
Yes, well, it's great. And let me congratulate you yet again on your PhD. That's wonderful.
Thank
and
you.
Going to Zurich, I'm sure, will be wonderful. I'm hoping to come and visit.
You must.
Well, maybe we'll do the next one there.
Yes.
Fantastic.
Yes.
Tricia Churchland, Molly Crockett, thanks very much.